Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to take a look at a couple of cases, including Dr. Peter Bregan, a leading psychiatrist, who says, isn't it time we stop drugging children? I would agree. We'll see what you think. Also, WikiLeaks reveals the real reason Julian Assange is being abandoned. And then Utah says, a young lady broke the law. This is one of the most absurd laws imaginable. We'll deal with that. And then today, a continuation of special essays that Richard Gale and myself have written. And this we wrote over the last 5 days, and I'll be including this as a part of our overall program to educate people about the truth of our environment. We won't have time for call-ins today because we have a packed show. So let's begin with the latest on health and healing. This comes from Emory University, and it's about probiotics. Thousands of articles have been written about how we need probiotics, especially if we've not had the healthiest diet, especially if we've had sugars and refined carbohydrates, pastas and breads and cakes and pies and pizzas, pretzels in our diet. Most people have. So the probiotics in their intestines are not in the dominant way, but unhealthy disease-causing bacteria are. So new treatments with good bacteria, widely used in probiotic supplements, can strengthen the bones, especially in females. That's a new study that was just found in treating bone loss conditions, osteoporosis. And this was simply the lactobacilli, and that's the good bacteria. Quote, the significance of the study is that probiotics are, at least in this scientific experiment, an effective means to increase bone density. And that was from Emory University. So use your probiotics every day and have stronger bones. From Georgia Institute of Technology comes a study about dehydration. This is published in Georgia's Institute for Technology. And it says that when you're dehydrated, your brain will swell, making it harder for you to complete everyday tasks, but you won't be aware of it. In fact, dehydration can cause both physical and mental changes in the body, and it negatively impacts cognitive function. The study was published in the Journal of Psychological Reports. And dehydration, by the way, is a deficiency of water in the body, and occurs when the body's fluid loss is greater than its fluid intake. Now, normal body functions like urinating and perspiring and crying and even breathing all contribute to fluid loss. And the symptoms of dehydration include bad breath, dry skin, headaches, increased thirst, dry mouth, tiredness, and dizziness. Now, those also can be symptoms of other conditions, but this is one that we rarely pay attention to. And this was done at the Biological Science Division of Georgia's Tech School. And why this is important, because for decades now, 45 years, I've helped over 30,000 individuals with our coaches, Peter Roth and John Q, Dolores Perry and others, to complete the New York City Marathon. And these are people who are not elite athletes. In fact, many had never done a race in their life. This was the first race they'd ever done. Every single one completed it. And it changed their lives because now they saw what they could do when their mind was no longer the limiting factor. We are called the Natural Living Running and Walking Club for a reason, because we study the science, and for decades we had weekly meetings to go over how your exercise impacts your body. Now, the number one nutrient in the body is water. It represents upwards of 72% of your total body weight. And then the quality of that water is important too. We get a lot of our minerals from water, if it's healthy water. And otherwise, when we start drinking coffee or carbonated beverages, the caffeine actually acts as a diuretic, and we lose water. So the more coffee you drink, the more dehydrated you're going to become. And then we have several types of perspiration. We have sensible, insensible, and profuse. When you're out working out with the new shoes that are designed, they're designed to wick water off, as are the socks. So you could get back from a 10-mile workout and your socks are not wet. But what has happened is that insensible perspiration has allowed pints of water to evaporate through your feet, meaning the feet will release the minerals and the water, and you won't notice it. During the daytime, we perspire, and the more restricted areas of our body, our groin, our armpits, feet, perspire the most. But then you have people that have a different metabolism, and they perspire very profusely all the time. And the body is trying to cool itself when it's perspiring. It wants to keep an even body temperature no matter how hot or cold outside. So it can constrict the blood vessels, and hence you turn a little blue, but the body's holding in heat, or you're very hot, in which case the body wants to lower that temperature to a safer range, and you sweat. We don't take into account people in hospitals or nursing homes or assisted living centers frequently don't have anyone check how much liquid they've consumed, nor are they checking whether or not they've eaten the right amount of nutrients. And no one is given special attention more often than not because of their physical abnormalities. It's like, well, we prepared a meal, everyone, this is your breakfast, this is your lunch, this is your dinner, unless there's a dietitian giving very specific instructions. But that has come from a physician. More often than not, physicians don't have the time on a daily basis to go through a nursing home and take a look at 50 or 100 or 200 patients. So we are having people die in nursing homes and hospitals of malnutrition and dehydration. But then we start losing our sweat and water, and we're not rehydrating. Frequently, we'll take a little bit of water, but we've lost a lot, and it accumulates. And one of the very first things you see is fatigue. Fatigue is almost always the first sign you're dehydrated. Muscle cramps, another. Then you start having a dry, bad breath. Dry mouth, bad breath, another. So these are some things plus local pain. And of course, what you're not paying attention to is your blood. Your blood thickens. You do not want thick blood. You want bright red blood, you want it oxygenated, and you want those red blood cells, corpuscles, to be evenly spaced. Because then they don't aggregate and clump together, creating a clot that leads to a stroke or heart attack. So hydration is really important. And then if you're doing extra sweating because of extra exercise or the weather that you're out in, just keep that in mind. From Columbia University Medical Center comes a study published in the American Journal of Cardiology. It talks about the ultimate stress buster. And what is it? L-theanine. Thea, T-H-E-A, nine, N-I-N-E. And that's important because stress can cause heart damage equal to smoking 5 cigarettes. But people who don't smoke at all, and people who smoke generally smoke more than 5 cigarettes. But when people are stressed, they're stressed all the time. Now, this is according to the latest study at Columbia University's Medical Center. So to state the obvious, let's make stress reduction by way of diet and lifestyle changes a top priority. The fact of the matter is, chronic stress is life-threatening, especially as it relates to the cardiovascular system. The study we're talking about right now deals with an amino acid, and you'll notice amino acid if the word ends in N-I-N-E, nine. And because L-theanine reduces both stress levels and heart rate, as weight increased stress levels, scientists ask participants to solve mental stressful tasks in 4 double-blind trials. Theanine was given to participants in one of the 4 trials before dealing with the stressful task. In the second group study, subjects took theanine midway through the work, And the third and fourth variation, subjects were given a placebo, though they didn't know it, both during and before the tasks. In comparison to the placebo group, there was a reduced amount of immunoglobulin. That, by the way, is a stress marker in saliva released by the immune system after exposure to viruses or bacteria or other foreign entities, and a lower heart rate in participants who took theanine. The researchers explained that theanine works by suppressing the sympathetic nervous system responsible for the fight-or-flight response during emergency situations. And this is achieved by blocking a chemical known as glutamate, or L-glutamic acid, that carries electrical signals transmitted from nerve cells to the rest of the body cells. The conclusion was that L-theanine plays a major role in terms of influencing the psychology, which is your mind, and the physiology, your body, functions during stressful situations. Also, we find that a large study talks about plant-based compounds can boost your brain function, especially if you're over the age of 50. This is from the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia. And I mentioned one study last week that if you get the rainbow fruits and vegetables, the yellows, the oranges, the purples, the reds, greens, these are all very important, not just because they're chlorophyll, but because these are the phytonutrients from fruits and vegetables, and we need them. They really help, and especially the carotenoids. And if we get enough of these, then it helps not just bolster better vision, but also better cognitive health as you age. And what is known is the neural mechanisms underlying the relationship between these compounds and cognition. And this is important because if you have a lot of fruits and vegetables, your brain will be less inflamed. And with a less inflamed brain and more of the natural nutrients to energize the brain, you're going to be a quicker thinker, a sharper thinker, and have better recall memory. Now, this has been proven with MRI technology and to gauge the brain activity of the adults over 65 to 85 and who are attempted recall word pairings they were taught earlier. And when they did this analysis, they found that those that had the highest amount of fruits and vegetables had the best brain recall. One more reason to get your fruits and vegetables, either fresh organic, great, or juiced, terrific. One or two or three glasses of vegetable and fruit juice a day would just help the brain and the body so much and thin the blood and protect your heart and give you more energy at the mitochondrial level. Or concentrates, and finally, the most powerful are powders, because powders have the highest concentration. You would have to eat a bushel basket full of fruits and vegetables, especially vegetables, to get what you get in just a tablespoon of powders from which that was taken. Whatever way you choose to get it into your body, do so, because it's going to help your brain. From the University of Michigan comes a study that shows that fiber protects colonic mucosa. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell and reported the findings that an international research team that when you have high fiber in the diet, there's your plant and vegetables again, you have the ability of these microorganisms to protect the colon, and that's important. So the more fiber, the better the bacteria, the healthier you are. And finally, from Kaduna State University in Nigeria comes a study published in the European Journal of Medicinal Plants showing that chili peppers are a very powerful natural cure for depression. So that's good news to those who are suffering from depression. It's one piece of a puzzle, but the pepper extracts exhibit very good antidepressive effects. So any of my friends who ever see me eat, and I'm not a big eater, I eat small meal. I use a lot of cayenne pepper. I mean a lot. And that's for different reasons. It thins the blood. It's purifying. helps with pain in anywhere in the body. And they actually did a study showing that against an antidepressant drug, the cayenne pepper did better. So just, we want to give you the latest on everything. And I'm Gary Nolm. We're 15 minutes into our program. We've got a lot to share, so we're going to take a break and come back. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world who are tuning in. One primary reason many of you have said that you tune in is because we do more discussions and articles, write more articles, and report on more articles than any other radio or television program in America. I'd like to share now, at the beginning of this longer discussion, two different concepts. One will explain in a commentary, original commentary, why I believe that as a society we're fully aware and have the intellect and the technology, we have the resourcefulness to impact global warming in a positive way. But then when I look at the other side of that equation, because I've interfaced in my clinical practice with tens of thousands, over 50,000 people, plus all the lectures, over 6,000 lectures I've done in my career, and all the people I've gotten information back, I see that good people, caring people, sensitive people, want to see a healthier environment. They don't want to see the extinction of species, let alone humans. But at the same time, when I ask them, are you willing to change your diet completely to a plant-based diet? Are you willing to stop buying stuff you don't need? Are you willing to live a more ascetic life? Are you willing to downsize? Then you start to see the cognitive disconnect. And that is where we're at. So with all of our meetings and plans, thousands of discussions between thousands of scientists and policymakers and environmentalists, we all pretty much agree, at least 97% of agree, that global warming is real, environmental disasters are present and increasing, and we must address them. That is a consensus. Then the question is, why aren't we individually doing it, or collectively? Either our government at the state or federal level, or individuals or corporations. But the reality is we're not. A reporter from a major network can talk about global warming and then go out and have themselves, you know, a steak and see no irony in it. And that's why this essay is so important. It's from Richard Gell myself. It's called The Climate is Changing, So Why Do We Refuse to Change Also? I'll begin by giving you an example, Phyllis. Phyllis is a very conscientious environmentalist. She goes beyond the call of duty to spread the word about climate warnings through the organization she belongs to and her social media network. She travels, sometimes long distances, to join climate marches and to demonstrate against tar oil pipelines and hydrofracking projects, nuclear projects, and especially against Monsanto's agenda to destroy the world's agricultural base. And like many of her other educated younger adult friends, she has schooled herself about the consensual science predicting that humanity's time on Earth is rapidly winding down. And she has the skills to communicate this message. Yet, Phyllis also has an enduring faith in her generation, the millennials, capacity for rebelling in their spirit to turn the tide against accelerating climate change, in her mind relying upon human ingenuity to apply cutting-edge science and technological innovation to the climate crisis, and that will solve everything. There is one slight problem, however, and Phyllis has overlooked it. While she makes fierce demands that the government, the big fossil fuel polluters, and the Wall Street investment class make radical changes to save the planet, her own lifestyles mirror the same belief system held by these climate destroyers. She continues to abide by a meat-based diet while disregarding whether it's a car-grilled beef or produced chicken. She is also hooked on buying and consuming more and more stuff beyond her personal means and needs. Her charged credit cards reflect that the nation's addiction is piling up into unpayable debt. She's a part of that. So Phyllis is not alone. This is a similar ethos shared by many intelligent, conscientious people who are fully aware of the problems our species faces in the future and who implore others to change while they themselves refuse to do the same. They just are unwilling to do it themselves. In simply dabbling with making small changes in a person's life is ultimately trivial and worth nothing. So taking a deeper look, we discover that Phyllis's cognitive dissonance, the mental state of holding inconsistent beliefs and attitudes that are in conflict with our personal behaviors, and a lack of motivation to find balance and harmony between thoughts and actions, was also evident in the results of the U.S.'s recent midterm elections. Now, while the Democrats pride themselves for their commendable victory to retake control over the House, the future of the planet and the U.S. environment did not fare as well. Although five newly elected freshman representatives ran on climate change platforms, nine others are scientists who oppose the GOP's fantasy of global warming denialism and state measures to address climate change will have to take a back seat, at least for the time being. And with the Trump administration ravaging regulatory safeguards to protect the air and environment and opening the floodgates wider for the world's largest corporate polluters and emitters of greenhouse gases to rise to higher prominence, we have to now rely upon state and local governments to pass and enact effective climate policies. Unfortunately, the midterm elections proved we are failing dismally in that direction. Climate-related initiatives on state ballots, which may have helped usher a Green New Deal, took a beating. A Washington Post article headlined it succinctly, "Voters rejected most ballot measures aimed at curbing climate change." Wow. This occurred unexpectedly in some of the least likely states. In progressive Washington, a bill would have divided revenues from a carbon emission tax to invest in clean energy and clean air to improve water resources, preserve forests, and protect the health of rural communities that are most negatively impacted by climate change. Washingtonians voted against the measure by siding with a $20 million spent on the fossil fuel corporations to defeat the initiative. In Colorado, a measure to reduce fossil fuel drilling on non-federal land in close proximity to residential homes also failed. And just to put that into perspective, whoever owns the mineral rights, if they own the mineral rights, they can come and put a gigantic gas hydrofracking well right on your property, right next to your house, pollute your water, pollute the air, have 24/7 noise, decimate everything, and you can't do a thing about it. And the states are not allowing you to do anything about it. The states also are impacted by the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC groups, that have been around for over 30 years and have passed tens of thousands of bills as laws, but never once do their fingerprints show up on any of those laws. Your legislators meet in secret with these powerful 250 or so corporations, their representatives, and those corporations give them already finished bills and coach them on how to sell it in their state. So if you're wondering why in the world did Pennsylvania and New York and other states allow, in California, allow gas hydrofracking without any protections and any impact study prior to doing any of this, it's because they control it. They control your state houses. And they also have controlled the same thing in Arizona. And that's unfortunate because then that means the state is moving away from renewable energy. Montana voters disapproved requirements for mining companies to provide convincing structural assurances that polluted water resources would remain unpolluted nor drain into the natural environment before new permits are granted. Again, that's heavy lobbying behind the scenes. So this disparity between electing Green Deal representatives to Washington's federal citadel, legislators who realize climate change is a national priority, from the states denying the same, is indicative of the cognitive dissonance that pervades the American landscape. This psychological incongruity is a bargain with the devil. Americans' delusional sense of entitlement that they deserve whatever they want in order to perpetuate the status quo so as to avoid making difficult life-saving decisions is the dry tinder that reassures living conditions will only get worse. Consequently, this cultural impasse has made the national population inept in responding to the growing threats of extreme weather events like wildfires and drought and superstorms and heat waves and flooding that are increasing annually. And to try to better understand this biopolarity regarding the climate that is now embedded into the cultural narrative of the American psyche, we had an opportunity to speak with Professor Per S. Epson Stoknes at the Norwegian Business School, which is Europe's second largest business college. And Professor Stoknes is the director of the school's Center for Climate Strategy. He also studied at the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich and has written extensively about the psychology of climate change and economics and money. Having a profound understanding of the depth psychology and possessing an ecological and spiritual sensibility, he has been able to probe into the hidden recesses of our Western culture psyche that very few legislators and climate activists have been able to diagnose clearly or even be interested in. We keep everything involving the climate on a political or economic level. We can't afford to do that, so we're not going to. Or we don't believe that it's that serious, so we're not going to. Rarely, if ever, do we say, yeah, we all pretty much agree, but we're not going to do anything. Why not? You could marshal the resources, the science, got a lot of bright people. Nope, it goes deeper than that. Well, how deep does it go? What does it mean? And that's what I wanted to find out from Professor Stoknes, because he's identified four primary narratives that characterize the dominant belief system now crippling any constructive and determined efforts to lessen humanity's detrimental habits and behavior upon this planet. First, an over-reliance on individualism. That's our sense of entitlement to extract all that's necessary to maintain a comfortable lifestyle. Have you ever found a very rich person who said, I have enough? No. This is simply out of alignment with the way the earth functions. And we know that we're not individuals isolated from nature. We're not independent from the air we breathe or other species we coexist with to sustain our lives and our health. And second, our reliance upon reason and rationality is remarkably limited. In fact, our dependence upon reason is irrational. referring to the latest research in neurosciences and psychology, New York University's Jonathan Haidt eloquently lays out the case in his The Righteous Mind that we are all intrinsically irrational creatures. Nor can we reason ourselves into being unwavering optimists about our human genius to solve climate problems. When attempting to predict the future about climate change, pure optimism is filled with consistent failings, and it makes no sense. Third, Western culture has been abnormally anthropocentric. In other words, humanity hoodwinks itself into believing we are the sole and final measure for all of creation. Well, this completely irrational dogma, which underlies the radical free market capitalist agenda, also flies in the face of reality. Humans aren't the center neither of everything nor of all life on Earth. Many religious creeds, particularly the literalist and fundamentalist, interpret things based upon their religion, whether it's a Bene Israel, which also wallow in climate denial, hold only to the belief that human beings alone are sacred. And such religious vanity also is anthropocentric and fails to perceive the sacred inherent throughout nature. Even today, it was discovered in a new article that the killer whales, the oryx, have the same capacity for reasoning and feeling and sharing as do humans and chimpanzees. That just came out today. If you ask these reductionists, they're just big fish. No, there are a lot more. Finally, the belief that winning trumps all other ethical norms, or what Stoknes calls heroism. It's the engine that's driving our civilization towards a systemic, climate-generated collapse. Government policies and corporate activities are based upon acquiring the most benefits in the least amount of time. Yet this self-destructive ethic completely ignores humanity's coexistence with nature and therefore the dire need to find long-term solutions. We might also add a study published by Uppsala University in Sweden that identified and defined the primary characteristics driving climate change denialism and people's anemic efforts to change their behavior in order to adapt to the new world climate change is bringing forth. The study is particularly noteworthy at this time when the nation is violently divided between left and right, liberal and conservative, religious and non-religious, and is shedding any fragile threads of national cohesiveness apart. Repeatedly, we hear people stating that within the past several years, they feel the United States has descended into a directionless state, a Tower of Babel, imbued with chaotic uncertainty. It also explains why the Trump administration and the GOP and the goons and the alt-right movements and the alt-left movements are unconsciously determined to follow the trajectory leading to humanity's demise and extinction rather than tackle the challenges of global warming. So according to the university researchers, climate change denial is strongest in people who accept hierarchical authoritarian social structures and value toughness and dominance over empathy and compassion, who are exceptionally closed-minded and fearful of new experiences, and are predisposed to experiencing unhealthy emotions. Climate denialism is also far more prevalent in among the men who embrace a social dominance orientation that pits themselves into an emotional warfare against others. It therefore follows that these will be the same people most likely to experience unfortunate psychological conditions once they become victims of climate catastrophe. That would be like the person who says, I'm not going to move. I don't have to move. My family's been here for six generations, right here. But you're in harm's way of a hurricane, the beach is eroding, and the tides are increasing. I don't care. And then one day, there's a storm. Maybe a Category 1 wipes out their house. They'll be the first out on the beach in the morning, punching the air and saying, it's my government, why wasn't I warned? always blaming someone else for their own poor choices. So climate-related catastrophes are already fueling an epidemic of adverse mental health disorders. The American Psychological Association sponsored a study through the College of Worcester to evaluate the impact extreme weather conditions are having on Americans' behavior and psychological health. Quote, due to trauma and distress, due to personal injuries, loss of a loved one, damage to or loss of personal property, or even the loss of livelihood, rates of post-traumatic stress disorder, mood, and anxiety disorders are increasing. This, too, will have further economic burden upon governments and families. It is another indication that we need to urgently learn to perceive climate systematically and as a threat that will have profound negative consequences upon every aspect of our lives and our communities. And since the scientific consensus affirms the climate crisis henceforward will get bleaker, so will people's mental and physical health conditions. As the Australian public ethics scholar Cleve Hamilton remarks in his Defiant Earth, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene, quote, if not every human being is responsible for bringing on the Anthropocene, every human is destined to live in it. In an earlier article, we noted how the environmental and humanitarian crisis due to climate change is an economic crisis. But we should further expand upon this and identify the deep spiritual crisis in Western civilizations as well. The destruction of the climate and environment is also a collective cancer. And clearly the message most commonly used to warn others is not being communicated effectively. We have to argue that this is the failure of the pro-climate and pro-environmental movements to create and propagate stories that will induce enthusiastic change instead of apathy. Therefore, we should offer the four archetypal narratives to more deeply personalize the climate change narrative. First, we must communicate the need to revise a new healthy economy that is green and regenerative. This is something every American can relate towards. Yet this story must emphasize the mobility to reach zero fossil fuel emissions, sustainable agriculture that will be more resilient to the droughts and floods ahead. The agrochemical industrial model of the Monsantos and the Bayers in the world cannot promise this, and there is no sound independent science whatsoever in big agriculture's favor. It's all against them, yet they hold power. Therefore, the new narrative must convey assurances of stability while at the same time diversity. Social and ecological values need to be sown and grown to balance the natural capital of world with financial capital of economies and the market. Secondly, we need to argue we must change our narrative about what defines a true quality of life. This story must reorient us towards our coexistence on the earth and the satisfaction and joy such as a relationship brings. At a national level, the fallacy that the gross domestic product is any indicator of the health of an American population, and that needs to be trashed and replaced with an equation that recognizes the quality of an average person's life and also the health or disease of nature and the quality of its capital that civilization depends upon. And third, since religion shows no signs of going away anytime soon, it can still serve as a vehicle of inspiration to reorient ourselves towards protecting the earth and the climate and each other. Pope Francis' encyclical for greening Catholicism is one example that shifts humanity's inflated sense of self as the ruler over the planet to become the stewards who protect nature. Professor Stokes remarks, this means we need to also be the voices of those who have no voice from the animal and the plant kingdoms. Now, such a shift will strengthen a sense of spiritual connection, and that will cut through the conflict between the theist and the atheist humanist. All beliefs can find common ground in the desire for self-preservation. Even an evangelical fanatic such as St. Bernard of Clairvaux, who preached fire and brimstone epistles to fill the ranks of the medieval Crusades, would experience a deep coexistence with nature when he wrote, "What I know of the divine sciences and holy scriptures I learn in the woods and fields. I have had no other masters than the beeches and the oaks." Finally, Stokeney's suggests we develop biphilia. Now, what's that? That's a love for nature that is sensitive towards the balances between nature that have undergone many epics to develop and to witness the beauty permeated throughout nature. This ethic of rewilding ourselves will ensure and enable us to work in greater harmony with nature's cycles and currents rather than work against them, that is now the norm of our capitalist-driven society. I believe that this is a blueprint as a step in the correct direction. We have few other options to stave off accelerating global warming. Inevitably, we all must begin to prepare ourselves for unpleasant and socially disruptive times ahead, I believe within the next 3 years, 5 years at the latest. Perhaps if many more of us collectively make the committed effort to give up the destructive narratives inherited from our egocentric death culture and adopt narratives that bring us into closer harmony with nature and our world, there will be a realistic glimmer of hope. I'm Gary Nall. Those are some views in this opening essay. Back in a moment. From all over the world, I'd like to say thank you for joining us. This is the program, the number one listened to progressive program on the planet. Over 100 million downloads. And by the way, if you want to get an idea of how many people are searching out our documentaries on YouTube, just Google. Try it right now. Google Bowling for Columbine. All right. Google Fahrenheit 9/11. Two of very popular films by Michael Moore. All right, and you'll see a number there, search results. Now Google the War on Health, where we're the top many spots. Compare that number, and you'll see there's a whole lot of people interested in other realities, other truths. Try it. I'd like your feedback. You can go to prnstudio@gmail.com to share that. Also, I want to take a break for a moment here, because we have on the phone Lou Ann Panessi, and we have a woman, I'm told, I haven't spoken with her, from the retreat we just held. Hi, Lou Ann.
Hello, Gary. Hi, everyone. Yeah, I thought I'd invite Carol on to tell her story. She's such an inspiration. And as you know, I interview everyone before they come to our retreat. And I had a very long interview with Carol, and she wasn't really sure if she was going to join us or not, but she did. And the results are just amazing. So I'd love for her to share her story.
Hi.
This is Carol.
Hi, Carol. Tell us your story, please.
Yeah, so as Luann said, I just spent 2 weeks at the retreat in Texas. I was extremely hesitant to go. I'm very overweight. I didn't exercise. I ate a typical American diet of very unhealthy food. And I hadn't been in a pool for 30 years. And Luann said, get yourself a bathing suit and you'll get in the pool. And I did. I knew I needed to make a change in my life or I wasn't going to be around to worry about making a change. So from the moment I arrived, everyone was very welcoming and supportive. I walked every day. I spent hours in the pool doing aerobics. I learned. I meditated. I tuned into my mind and my body. And I ate a healthy vegan diet. Nobody there had an agenda. Nobody was critical. Nobody gossiped about people. Everybody was just extremely encouraging and supportive. The environment was absolutely beautiful and so conducive to learning and thinking. And all of these things I carried home with me. I'm eating a vegan diet. I'm not hungry. And I continue to lose weight. I work with a trainer at my gym. I walk. I even joined a pool and bought the aerobics equipment that I used in Texas so I can continue with my program. I have your cookbook, and I actually use it. I have hope again. I continue to learn. I watch your educational videos every day. The retreat was just life-changing. All of the people that were there, everybody just gave me the tools that I need to change my life, and I've reclaimed my life. So I very strongly urge anybody to go there and try it. Gary, you have generously provided this enormous opportunity for people, and you give us your time, your knowledge, the wonderful location to do it all in, and I truly believe that you have saved my life with all this information and giving us the support that we need. So I really thank you for that.
Okay, Carol, you and I have not spoken before right now, so I'm going to ask you a few questions. If you could give us short answers, please. Did you have any life-threatening conditions before you came down?
Aside from what my weight was doing to me, I had no life-threatening conditions, but I did take omeprazole every day because I had a difficulty with acid reflux. I did have cancer in the past, but I've been cancer-free for 5 years.
How many pounds overweight were you?
150.
Overweight?
150 pounds overweight, yes. And so far,
all right,
I have lost 30 pounds since October 1st.
Good. Okay, and how's your blood pressure and blood sugar now, and how's your gastric reflux?
I do not take any omeprazole anymore. I take vitamins and nutrients that Luann has suggested and that you suggest in your protocols, and my blood pressure is good.
Good. Well, you're on your way then. Good for you. How far did you walk down there?
I got up to about 3 miles a day, which I know in comparison to everybody else isn't very far, but from what I was doing, it was amazing.
What could you do before?
Nothing. I would get out
of bed. So from nothing to 3 miles is...
Yeah.
So how many miles could you walk now?
Now, I walk my 3 miles every day, and I'm working on increasing my speed because I was
Good.
Going very slowly. So now every day I walk a little bit faster, and then I try.
Well, then you've lost more than
twice a day.
You've lost more than 30 pounds because as you're exercising, which you're doing, you're burning fat and laying down muscle. Muscle weighs twice as much as fat. So I would say that you probably have a total net difference of 50 pounds. And considering that was just in October, that's terrific. Carol, thank you very much. And just to let people know, we're going to be doing in only 1 week, because that's all my schedule will allow. I'm out filming. I'm going to come back for it. It'll be at a different location, starting the second Saturday in January. And we're going to be full probably in a day or two. So, Luann, if people would like to join us for our January retreat, what is the number that they can call? And also, does anyone know if Sean Bhatnagar is still alive and healthy? I haven't heard from Sean in several years, and I'd like to. And he was a friend since the early 1970s. I'd like to see how he's doing. So give your phone number out, Luann.
Sure. It's 903-881-7008. Again, it's 903-881-7008. Give me a call if you're interested, and I'll be happy to speak with you.
Okay. Thank you, Luann, and we look forward to having people who began a true journey of change and hopefully healing. It's all possible. We've seen it done so many times in the past. Just a quick note, for those of you who haven't seen the 15 separate articles we've written challenging Wikipedia's legitimacy, accuracy, and honesty and objectivity, please look at them. Share them with everyone you can. I believe that it's time that we saw the truth about the so-called experts and the skeptics and the editors who work for Jimmy Wales at Wikipedia. And it's time that you ask yourself, should you continue supporting this after you see what they've done to so many people? Also, the articles on vaccination, the articles on GMOs, and the latest articles on the environment. Download them and share them. I'm going to share now some comments from latest news reports, and I just want to run down because we like to hit on things that other people are not dealing with. And one of these is, we keep talking about how robotics and artificial intelligence are trying to take the place of many more expensive technologies, like medicine, for example, or some part of medicine, either in diagnosing or treatments. Well, according to global research, Ethan Huff, in the name of scientific progress, Newcastle's Freeman Hospital in the United Kingdom recently tried to pioneer the use of a surgical robot that is tasked with repairing a patient's damaged heart valve. Went wrong, the robot ended up killing the person on the operating table, and it's the first time robots not only physically assaulted a living medic while attempting to conduct its programmed surgery, but also implanted stitches into the patient's heart in a manner that was wrong. So that didn't go well, and I'm sure there's going to be other instances of that. But we should not allow the idea, because something is new and would relieve a human of making the decisions during the work, that it's automatically going to be great. It won't be. I've noticed everywhere the increase in social drinking. How many ads make it seem cool and hip, sexy to be drinking? And if you take away all the advertisements, take away the label and the artwork, take away the special music and promotion, the celebrity endorsements, all you're dealing with is something that burns your mouth and tastes bitter. Or like vodka, doesn't have any taste at all, but burns your mouth. So what we're dealing with is something that's completely manufactured, the illusion. Here is the reality. This is from Jane O'Donnell from USA Today. The last time lawyer Erica Byrd talked her way out of an alcoholic rehab center, her father took her to lunch. "Dad, I know what alcohol has done to me," she told him that day in January. "I know what it has made me do to you and Mom, but that wasn't me." By the time she died 3 months later, she had blocked her parents' calls because they kept having her involuntarily committed. They once had a magistrate judge hold a hearing at her hospital bed. He ordered her to undergo a month of inpatient treatment. Byrd, who died at the age of 42, is among the rising number of people in the United States who have been killed by alcohol in the last decade. How serious is it? Well, the opiate epidemic is serious, but alcohol kills more people each year than overdoses. And it kills you through cancer, liver cirrhosis, pancreatitis, suicide, among other ways. In fact, it's increased in women a tremendous increase, over 67% increase in women. How many people die each year in the United States because of their drinking? 88,000. That's a serious number. This was published in Alcoholism Clinical and Experimental Research. So we have a big alcohol problem. But then again, we have a bigger problem in that not willing to be honest about why people drink and how we make it cool for people to drink in colleges. And more women than men are engaged in binge drinking, and that can really kill you. So I've said it a long time ago, and I'll continue to say there's no such thing as a healthy drink. From the motherboard, Nafees Ahmed, the UN's devastating climate change report was too optimistic. The IPCC has been criticized for being, quote, too alarmist. If anything, it is the opposite. With their latest report, they have been overly conservative. Wow. So overly conservative, they're saying we have 12 years left. And he's saying, you're wrong. You're way wrong. In a landmark paper, Professor James Hansen, who was then head of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, along with seven other leading climate scientists, described how a global average temperature of 1 degree Celsius involving a level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of around 450 parts per million would lead to, quote, practically irreversible ice sheets and species loss. But they added new data showing that even 1% was too hot. So at the time the paper was issued in 2008, atmospheric concentrations of CO2 were already at 385 parts per million. This is, quote, already in the danger zone, explained Hansen and his colleagues, noting that most climate models excluded self-reinforcing amplifying feedback loops, which would be triggered at this level. Things like ice sheet disintegration and vegetation migration and greenhouse gas release from soils and tundra and the ocean sediments. Well, all these different feedback loops constitute tipping points, which once triggered can lead to irreversible or even runaway climate change processes. So according to Hansen and his authors, these feedback loops may begin to come into play on timescales as short as, well, and then it goes in, take it from there wherever you want. I believe it's 5 years or less. So today we are well in breach of the 1 degree Celsius limit. And we have breached this limit at a much lower level of atmospheric CO2 than Hansen thought would be necessary to warm this much. As of May 2018, the monthly average atmospheric CO2 had reached 410 parts per million. August, it was and it was at 409 parts per million. This is the highest CO2 level the Earth has seen in 800,000 years. So we're on that runaway path. And so he's saying, we're not alarmist enough. Well, go to the webinar I just did. 6 hours. 4 hours live, too, that you could download. 6 hour webinar on climate change. And listen to people who have something to say. We have a big suicide problem in the United States. We're not talking about it. From EchoWatch, from 2000 to 2016, the suicide rate among American workers, working class people, increased 34%. And it's up. So a lot of people are killing themselves. People in construction, mining, drilling jobs. These are working class people. Their jobs are not secure. Their income is not secure. And so tens of thousands have committed suicide. This does not include 22 service personnel each day killing themselves, and almost all those people were on antipsychotic medication. Yet that doesn't get our attention, and it should. Because if you do the math, and let me just show you how we'll do the math. We're going to be conservative. Some say it's now 24 people. Let's just say 22 people a day times 365 days. That's 8,030 per year. And let's just go back to 17 years. And so times 17, you're at 136,510 American soldiers who have killed themselves by their own hand. I'm not including anyone who died in battle. Now, keep in mind, those are numbers that are twice, more than twice, of what we lost in the 10 years of the Vietnam War. Twice as many have killed themselves. Do you think that that would get someone's attention to have some congressional investigations to stop going into these conflicts, to stop putting people in positions where they see things, do things that normal people would never have to witness, and the guilt and the shame of what they have, the trauma that they've been through finally catches up with them? And I've interviewed over 1,000 Gulf War vets and vets from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they say that when you're in the battlefield, you do things you would never do in social life or civilian life, and it stays with you. So we should have a national dialogue on how to help these men and women understand how to deal with their trauma and pain without taking their own life. They deserve it, and we should do it now. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen today. Have a nice day, everyone.